Thank you very much, everyone. I'll hand over to my colleagues to raise some of the initial questioning. Anyone like to kick off? Andrew?
Well, since I'm at the end of the road, since you've asked me, Jeff, yes, I will. First of all, many thanks to all the speakers. Tim started off saying how can he do justice in 10 minutes, but I certainly think he did more than justice in 10 minutes to an extremely complex set of issues. But as we're in an academic environment, let's come back to the question on the exam paper, which is about food and poverty. I know it's grossly simplifying, but one of your take-home messages is that food is too cheap. We've got to internalise the externalities of food production. And therefore, starting with the exam question, if we've got symptoms of food poverty, undeniably, we've got food banks, we've got issues not just in this country, but in many developed economies, and we've had a system that has produced a lot of an abundance of food, choice of food, has kept prices low in real terms as well as low in environmental terms, then how is addressing the food system, those sustainability challenges, how is that going to address our poverty challenge? And I was saying to you before the session, I think as a commission we are trying to sort of understand what is this just a poverty issue? Is it a distributional issue? And I think, again, Dale gave us some insights into behaviour. It's really quite complicated. But to start with that cheap food thing, if food is too cheap, making food more expensive, that's not going to help us in terms of the current set of issues around poverty. So that's not a question, but it's a sort of reflection towards you.
Absolutely, and therein lies the conundrum. So let's take a step back and say, think about intergenerational equity. If we do not deal with the internalising the externalities, in the jargon terms, then we're going to make things far worse for a far greater number of people in generations to come. So imagine living in a 5-degree world. Where is the food going to come from? It's not going to be enough to live. Food. Feeding 11 billion or whatever the number will be at that time is going to be a real, real, real challenge. And unless we start dealing with it now, that challenge is going to get worse. So I think there are issues to do with, are we dealing with food poverty now or the spectrum of food poverty in the future? Second kind of comment is not flippant, but there will always be poor people and rich people. So if we move the price of food up, there will still be people who can afford it, and there will be big people who can't afford it. We make it even cheaper. There will still be people who can afford it and people who can't afford it. So no matter which system you are in the world, there is going to be poverty that we have to deal with. The question I think that perhaps is more relevant is who should pay for the cost of the real cost of food? So who should pay for the internalising the externalities? Should it be consumers? Should it be the public purse? And in some sense, I would say, for example, CAP is a route into making sure if that was properly directed, that would compensate farmers for managing the environment in a way that is much more environmentally sensitive than is necessarily done at the moment. And that could be a public safety net to maintain relatively cheaply. But ultimately, I think our ways of life lock us in not just to food systems, up to sky contracts and phone contracts and car loans and house loans and all the rest of that, so that the available money that is left is really quite constrained. So changing any of those, energy costs, transport costs, food costs, is going to create problems. And the trouble with food is it's one of those things that you can skimp on a daily basis. If you're poor, you can trade down, you can reduce the amount that you buy. And I think that is always going to be the case. For me, the issue is not how can we get rid of poverty in terms of through food pricing, it is what safety nets can we as a society put in place to help support those who will always be in a situation of poverty, no matter what price of food can be.
Yeah, I'd add a couple of things to that, really, which is that I think it's unhealthy food that's cheap comparatively. balance a variety of fruits and vegetables and less meat, less fatty meat, is the more expensive foods out there, and that's shown by poor people eat unhealthy foods, cheap and unhealthy. And unhealthy food is not necessarily bad for the environment. So research that's been done in Denmark, which is really quite interesting, looking at how people sort of come into poverty as a result of the economic recession of 2008, shows that those people's diets have become more sustainable since they went into poverty and less healthy. But they also feel relatively happy because they waste much less food, and that's a cultural discourse, and nobody wants to waste food. So they feel quite good that they're not wasting food, but they feel so good that they're eating lots of highly processed food. So it's actually not a blanket problem, it's a problem about who can afford what and how the food system is structured and organised such that the food that is easy to process and can be moved around and stored in freezers and therefore has a longer duration is essentially cheaper, even if it's less healthy. So that comes back a little bit to the, if you think about the way that we organise our food system from the end of consumption, where it's self-servicing, which I, by self-servicing I mean people go to supermarkets and cook their own meals, that system does create this kind of dynamic. So what would happen if you ate out more, if we continue to eat out more, if we had the provisioning of different kinds of eating out venues which are healthier or have a healthier and more sustainable set of options which maybe is subsidised, whether that's through workplaces or whatever. I think the example of Gillette's local and organic schools, that's exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about when I'm saying we need to think about how we organise our food. Obviously this is a long-term trend. The one point I didn't make during my talk is the scale of the problems that we're talking about warrant step changes. You know, we're not going to get there through small steps. And so trying to shift the way that we provision school time lunches in particular directions will have an effect on what those children are eating. I can see it in my children. My children are far more discerning in terms of what they eat. Fortunately, I'm relatively affluent and can afford to provision them with blueberries and all that kind of stuff. But they're getting that through the kinds of initiatives that Jeanette put in place. Not to sort of say that Jeanette feeds my children, but you know. So these are opportunities at the sort of more systemic level where the way that we provision our food and the way that we eat our food meat, where there's opportunities to create cultural shifts in our how we understand food and how it's organised. And of course then economies of scale, which might make healthy food cheaper.
I only want to add to that, it's a no-brainer. We've got facilities, we've got the schools, they're closed for some of the year. Why don't we open school? I've been a great advocate for opening schools up. We have catering facilities there, we have Dylan, the chefs there, we have school cooks there. Why don't we use them all through the year for the community? Because they're our core hub in the community. But the other thing about schools is that children often go from lunch to lunch, so the children are severe poverty, go from lunch to lunch without eating, and if they do, it's very poor what they have. And I think we have it's a moral issue, but I think as a society, adults who go hungry do other things and miss a meal or catch off somebody else or have a chocolate bar or something like that. The children that go hungry have no means by which to feed themselves. I think the issue about feeding children and preventing the child hunger is a really big one and hasn't been talked about enough. But we should be feeding children before they get home. Apart from anything else, it would stop them snacking as they go home at the sweet shop if you fed them before they get home at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. That's where we need to put the funding. That's the sort of stuff I would do. And we'd use the facilities we would have. In the war, there were the British restaurants, wasn't it? When everyone ate in sort of feeding kitchens. And it was good plain food. They everybody thought, I think, it would last for the war, but it didn't. But actually, maybe, you know, there's going to be a time when we have a feeding kitchen on a community British restaurant on every street to feed the community. Sorry.
Just on the trend on eating out, there's not systematic research, which I think is really quite interesting. We don't collect millions of data on how many potatoes people eat and how they get moved around. We don't actually have any systematic research on trends in eating out. What we do have is a study conducted 20 years, the first study of eating out conducted 20 years ago, where people ate one main meal every 3 weeks out of the home. And the market research data, which is not a direct comparison, suggests that one in six main meals are now eaten away from the home. That's a phenomenal change in 20 years, which could be used. People like eating out, it's got many virtues. We waste much less food when we eat out than we do when we eat at home, to a factor of five. So,
thanks. Neil?
I'd like to thank you for kind of painting how grim the picture is, both in terms of behaviour and sustainability. And I think that's a kind of given, that the current, the business as usual isn't an option. My concern is whether any of you have got any positive stories about where behaviour change or system change actually works. I mean, on a large scale, because we can always look at, you know, kind of small scale change or ethical change behaviour. You know, me and my kids, we eat well, but we're middle class and can afford it. You know, that's maybe 10% of the population. We're talking about system change that affects bulk of the population, including particularly people that haven't got the option of eating out, or if they do, it's McDonald's, it's not, you know, healthy option, high-end food. So what kind of either behaviour change or system change would you actually advocate that will achieve the step change that I think Dale referred to?
So I start to stab at this. Tim Wang, who we mentioned, is rather on the pessimistic side in terms of saying, well, we're so locked into our ways of doing it, the only thing that will reduce the lock-in is some major perturbation that will then create some freedom to change power structures and government structures and all the rest of that. So that's not answering your question, that's the kind of negative view, and I think there is some validity in that, in terms of when you ask a question like that, actually looking around, there are some examples of change, and there are some examples of small-scale issues where things have worked, but a lot of them are kind of sticking plasters. The biggest one, I would say, one is a kind of negative example, the Trussell Trust, for example, and some of this recycling of food and the supermarkets giving food away. That's a new institution which has shown a societal response that is creating a behavioural change, but it's not the sort of response we want. But it does show that there is some resilience. And for me, what is important really is the localism of the agenda, local communities helping themselves. Now, whether that is, there's a fire station somewhere telling me about in Ireland somewhere, which has gone tremendously green in the food it eats, the amount of recycling, growing its own stuff, acting as a hub in the local community about green and healthy living, up to the city food movement that Hillary's already mentioned. That's the city food movements, there are now 52 in the UK. Those are not government top-down, government pushed. These are community driven. And some of those are quite based on principles of equality as well as sustainability and nutrition and the middle class organic food localism movement. And some of those, I think, show that there is scope for communities to act together to work to effect change. Now, whether that will be enough without some central regulatory change or some big perturbation like a big weather event, or the Middle East blowing up and stopping some of the trade flows, the food getting hustled, and a big global food price spike, I don't know. Hillary.
Thank you. I don't have any examples, except to say that the Food for Life partnership, which goes into schools and inspires children, not all of them, but some of them, to take an interest in food. It's being exposed to, but as we know, the food industry operated in a bubble for many, many years, and it's being exposed to what is out there. I'm actually very interested in careers in the food industry and skills that are needed, because, like farming, the average of people that work in the food industry is older, then we need young, innovative, frightening people in the food industry to develop new products to feed the world. So I think that skills starting at school, interest, just being exposed to food and what it is actually very powerful, because it cascades out. They go home with it. They talk to them, the schools have cooking classes, they have going beds, all that sort of thing. So that's the sort of where I see the community changes that, but it is community led and not funded.
I think I've got four and a half examples. The first one, but I think the key thing to say is that when Tim talks about lock-in, I talk about lock-in. Lock-in is not always negative. In fact, lock-in happens all the time. You could just suggest it's inevitable. So therefore, the question is, how do we lock ourselves into, let's say, more virtuous patterns of eating? Because these things are going on anyway. These are processes that happen. It's not something that is done by some mysterious hand over there. It's all going on all the time. I'm needing more examples of where lock-in happens. My first example is lunch in Finland. As I understand it, in Finland had one of the worst heart disease rates in the 1970s, and the government dealt with it by instituting lunchtime. All workplaces over a certain number of employees were required to provide a lunch break. In fact, I think they even extended that now, so you have to provide your employees with 1 hour a week of where they're supposed to do sport and fitness. I'm looking at Matt because I think Sweden and the victims of having to play floorball without even realising it in the middle of a meeting. Quite badly, if I remember correctly. And of course, then they provide it through the workplace, and again with guidelines on the proportion of fruits and vegetables, and it changed the diet of the Finnish nation and radically improved heart disease outcomes. That's the first one. The second one, which I don't think is quite a sense of a deliberate policy, like the first one, but if you think of the diversity of what we eat today and the changes in culinary culture over the last 20 years, some of which has happened, let's say, organically as a consequence of popular interest, but also to do with a whole range of different government in policies, schools, the growth of supermarkets, essentially, and the rise of eating out has created a culinary culture. And like I said, my kids, what they eat is a world away from what I ate when I was their age, and I felt I probably ate quite well as a vegetarian, so you're forced in the 1980s to find interesting things to eat. Waste is a good example of where there has been quite significant improvements, and that's largely the production end, the supply side of in the way that Tim talked about, but also because governments have provided infrastructure for food recycling or food waste at the same time, perhaps not coordinated but likely through RAP, that supermarkets have taken action on things like sell-by dates and how they organise their promotions. The best example of systemic change that I can think of has nothing to do with food, but it's to do with sustainability and energy. And we did a report a few years back, which the challenge we were given is what are the most successful behaviour change initiatives. And the most successful behaviour change initiative happened in Japan. It's called CoolBiz. And this was where they wanted to reduce the energy consumption in government buildings, and they changed the default setting on the air conditioning units. At the same time, they then had a set of marketing campaigns and local initiatives to change what people wear in Japan in the office, which was very good for women because they were quite cold in these, because the culture was wearing suits for men and blouses for women. And the net outcome of that was, as we calculated it, the equivalent energy saving of three quarters of a million average US houses per year. Net tie sales went down by something like 30% a year, so bad if you're in the net tie business. Compare that with France's, at that point, the most systematic attempt to carbon labelling food products. The estimate from their figures is that saves at the equivalent energy of two US houses. So that's the difference between a campaign that looks systematically at an end point, that tries to tackle things by thinking about the way in which the consumption, the activities are organised, and together with some more conventional approaches to marketing and so on, compared with an approach which just thinks, let's give the consumers information and hope that they just follow suit. So we can think more systematically. And then perhaps a final one to do with food and sustainability is the growth of online shopping. Could potentially, needs to have evidence and data, could potentially make a big difference to the sustainability of food, in that we know that much of the carbon content of the food that we eat from the consumption end happens from the millions of people driving to the supermarket to pick up their food and driving it back again. Whereas a more coordinated and collective delivery systems may well make quite a big difference.
Thank you. Jeanette hasn't had it.
It's really interesting, and thank you, because I've really enjoyed listening to you. I'm not an academic, believe me. And we're hearing different opinions virtually every single day. We're talking climate change, global warming, food waste, the environment. A lot of these people now just need to feed themselves. How do we get to those people? Because even for me, I mean, Hilary, you spoke about change comes through education, and I really believe that. Food for Life now serves over 1 million meals a day through universities, early years, care homes, you know, schools. It's across the board now, and it's getting better. But, and over the years, I've been to probably 2,500 schools across the country and abroad. And I have to say, Sweden, Denmark, Rome, we've just finished doing a pilot project with them. And actually, they wanted to learn from us, which is fantastic. You know, that's probably the first I've ever, you know, to learn, for the Swedes to learn about English school meals was just phenomenal. And Japan as well. So we are global now. But I'm talking, when I go out, I'm talking to the converted. How do we get to the people that we need to get to? How do we get to those children whose only meal of the day is the school meal? As Hilary said, they go from lunch to lunch with nothing in between. And that's one thing I've not heard today.
You're the sociologist.
I haven't got an answer. I think it goes, unfortunately, as academics, we end up then going back to, it's to do with the way the system is structured, which creates these kinds of global inequalities, which doesn't actually really help in terms of answering directly the kind of question that you're asking. My point about the sovereign consumer and all of that stuff is that I feel that some of the debates that we have around these issues, and specifically the question you're asking, ends up being framed in the context of individuals make decisions about their life, and it's not the role of the state or anywhere else to interfere in that. And my point, I think, when I gave a similar talk once, and after a town planner stood up and said, you know, well, a typical sociologist, a bit like Stalin, wants to socially engineer the world that he lives in, and then went on to say that in planning Newcastle, they put walls at certain places to stop skateboarders from skating onto the pathway in front of more people. Entirely sensible, but that's socially engineering. So social engineering happens all the time. We need to, my rambling response is that I think there does need to be more leadership from governance. I know that there is no such thing as a single government, but more directed action. So Hilary was talking about, I think, the soup kitchens, but actually, you know, locally provisioned, almost state subsidised provision of soup. But could be one way of thinking about how you might go about getting food to different social groups. We won't do that because that goes against the idea of neoliberal economics and the society that we live in.
The issue with holding community group sessions, growing food, cooking food, having cooking lessons, is that if there's food involved and it's free, people will come because they like to eat. And we all know what a great social thing eating is all to do with social and cultural expectations. I get involved with cooking classes run again through the Time Bank in Harbour Holidays, right in Time Bank. And you and my brother, middle class, when I went to the first one, thinking, well, this is, you know, complete waste of time, and, you know, we'll cook in the kitchen in the community centre, and then we'll sit behind the wall and chat and have coffee, and then we'll give them the food, which actually we've charged for, and then we'll go home and we'll never see them, it won't make a difference at all. But actually, in the evaluation 6 weeks later, I was simply stunned and had my entire world turned upside down when I discovered that not only had they really taken quite a lot of stuff, but the people had gone home and done cooking for themselves, and even with very limited resources, and this was due to people who suffered mental health problems, and with very limited resources in renting places and things. And you think, well, if that changes just in the 6 weeks, the 2 hours I've been in the group for 6 weeks, then maybe you really can change the world. But my practical side said, you know, I look at the schools that I pass by and look at the number of something, find a school in Hull, and I look at them and they're closed from what, the second, third week in July till the beginning of September. You know, why are they closed? Why aren't we using them? Like we pay for them all, they're built with our money, you know, type text taxes, why aren't we using them to encourage food and nutrition and cooking and eating? And so that's, yes, I mean, there's a stigma attached to soup kitchens, but actually, if you're starving, you know, it does stick no matter. If we're starving, and we really are 3 days from anarchy, which the supermarkets say when oil runs out, you know, we'll have everyone out on the streets, because the one thing everyone will be after is food. We will have a revolution, and maybe that's the, I'm afraid I'm in one follow-up, here's the term, the preservation.
Yeah, is it Tim?
Just a quick thought. Mrs. Thatcher famously said there's no such thing as community. And part of the issue, I think, is that we have lost some of that local connectivity. My father was a priest in the Church of England, and I certainly grew up with a very strong community around where we, as a community, rallied around for helping each other in times of need. And some of that has disappeared. And the state and the shrinking of the state, not when tells people government that I'm saying these sorts of radical things, I think is a real problem, because it does mean that businesses are asked to step in where the state used to step in, and businesses step in where they can make a profit. And within the food system, where can you make a profit? You can make a profit in stacking them high, selling them really cheap, but bloody awful food with no nutritional value. Or if you can't afford that, then you're lost. So in a sense, I think we've got a poverty of social support mechanisms driven by a whole range of different things that are captured our neoliberal small statism and also the breakdown of traditional community structure. So in a sense, this comes exactly back to Dale's point. We can't think about food and poverty without thinking about the whole way of our communities and our social system structure.
Yeah. Andrew, then I want to say, and then I'll go over the floor to everyone else.
Lots of points in there that I wanted to sort of pick up and try to sort of synthesise a little bit. I mean, what you seem to be saying, and at the risk of gross overgeneralisation, that what we need is system change, not just in the food system, but beyond the food system. And certainly the recent part of my working career has been very much in the model that we have food companies and we have consumers, and somewhere in the middle, your nice funnel thing, we have retailers who, despite their small number, actually exercise quite a huge influence. But we've been labouring away trying to educate food companies to do things better, and in turn to educate their customers, and devices like labour. You're saying actually that's not a way forward. We do need interventions of a different sort. We can't leave it whether you call it market forces, but just the simple interactions between the sort of the actors in the value chain aren't going to achieve it by themselves. So we need a set of interventions. And given that we're in Department of Geography, people talked about localism, talked about planning. I mean, there are some pretty powerful tools there already without new regulation. You know, it's not an original thought, but you go down high streets these days and it's either charity shops, estate agents, or food outlets. And we've had the whole debate around big supermarkets. You know, do you think that using the existing tools, planning, urban design, things like that, you talked about the skateboards, but there are other things you can do to help structure communities. Now, that's not a quick fix, but there are things out there. So is that a failure of, is it a failure of political will? What's stopping those levers that are there from being used to help address these problems in a slightly more systematic way?
That's wonderfully summed up. Yes, that's exactly in a way what I'm arguing. I don't think we need to necessarily invent a whole new range of policy mechanisms, but to utilise the ones that we've got and to do that in a more systematic way. So what is the vision of the future of the way that we go about eating? I think it is partly a failure of political will, but I think it's a failure of the way in which debates have been framed for the last 20 odd years makes ideas around planning and urban design, the idea of super kitchens, any kind of state involvement in any kind of way of life as what you do for poor people, as a negative, unglossy NHS version of eating out compared with the nice. And I don't see why it necessarily needs to be that way. So we could have a far more, progressive and positive approach to the ways in which the kind of tools that we're talking about, planning, governance, setting incentives, where governments and politicians present visions of a positive future in which the state plays an active role alongside the market. Other people might have a different view on that, but I don't believe in... I don't think the market is useless. I think, you know, it's important. I think deregulation is important, not just adding more and more regulations on top of one another. But I think it needs to be reframed into a narrative or a vision, which is that we are all in lots of different groups, businesses, governments, policymakers are all designing and structuring, engineering, if you like, the world that we live in. So we have choices about how we might go about doing that, rather than letting those debates just pop away and say, well, it's individuals who make choices in markets and all we can do is tinker around the edges of that. So I think it's a reframing of the narrative as much as what we can actually do.
And I think there is an element here that we are so pressured financially, reframing the narrative will have transactional costs that will impinge on people. Well, just as an example of that, currently the back of the envelope calculation suggests that poor consumption in the UK costs each household about £2,500 in health service and social welfare costs. If we put a chunk of money into prevention and help people choose and eat more healthy diets, that would free up some of the crisis in the NHS. But until we have some more money in the public purse, that sort of thing looks unlikely, because we can't take money away from the NHS because it's under crisis. And so I think some of these issues around the social engineering of our urban environments, you could imagine that by investing in community-friendly kitchens, for example, you reduced the costs in other ways in the round, and it became a positive thing for a community. But to do that sort of investment has got all sorts of upfront costs that might mean taking money out of school budgets or some other things which are very tricky for political decisions to do. So although a lot of the regulations and the thinking could be in place, I think some of this lock-in, again, becomes quite difficult to imagine easy ways of doing it.
Just very quickly, we were very lucky this year on Hull had a local plan consultation. This is a a great huge amount which I don't think actually. And we, as Food for Hull, did responses to areas of green space in Hull, and Hull, of course, is not short of land. It's only fairly relatively recent, in the last 10 years, just had our last bomb site developed. So land for us is not a problem. So there's lots of land suitable for food growing. So I went into consultation and made lots of comments. And this was helped and guided by Captain Growth, who are the people in London who look after food growing in London. And there's been many supportive responses I gave have been endorsed by lots of other groups, friends of the Earth. In fact, I'm meeting the parks and statesman tomorrow at Hull City Council to talk about more growing, more incredible animals. Stuff. So it's possible, and there's been some suggestion about we've got one street that's just a wasteland of old big shops that are closed in the great boxes. You know, why don't we dig up the street, put gardens in, put residential houses, flats on top, and have real things that people want at the bottom, which may be, I'm going to live in a utopian dream most of the time, but maybe butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. But actually, the government suggested that and said that regulation could be overturned so that the retail can come and go back to residential, and then you have a live street again. But maybe we're just having to go back and slightly, as you say, reframe.
Thanks. I'd like to feed back to you some of the things I've drawn from what you said and get any response, and then open the floor to some questions. And by the way, folks, if you've got bits of paper, if you write things down on the bits of paper, whether they're questions or things we should look at as evidence, they will be collected at the end and everything will be looked at. I mean, I'd like to go back to your field, first of all, because, I mean, Tim, in a very broad way, said, look, the agricultural food system ain't working long term. We've had a blip. It's delivered a lot, quite quick, but it ain't sustainable. And you walk across the field and said, look, it's dead. And I was last week in Rome at the FAO's Commission on Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture, which just produced this book on climate change and the role of genetic resources, biodiversity. Now, the scale of the problems we're talking about are actually long term. It takes hundreds to thousands of years for soil to form. If you lose biodiversity, whether it's wild or agricultural, you don't get it back easily or at all. And they actually are the consequences, you're saying, of the way we run our food system today. And and by the way, everywhere in the world, the people who suffer most from the way we run our food system tend to be the poor. Whether they're rich, whether they're in a rich or a poor country, and in the world as a whole, they tend to be more rural. Urban, not here. So we actually are recognising we've got a really big problem in which we see a tip of an iceberg. Now, what I took from what you said, Tim, was the use of surplus or waste food to feed poor people is a no-no in any sensible long-term view of a sensible food system that's sustainable, because we shouldn't produce the waste or have the surplus in the first place, because that is environmentally bad. So what we're looking at the moment are lots of sticking plasters that we're seeing. But to get from the sticking plaster stage to actually healthy people, we need to do things which no one seems willing to take on board in a big way. But we are finding people at a local level everywhere recognising these problems. And one of the things that perhaps we've been challenged in a way that we haven't come to grips with yet is the UK and the world. Because as you pointed out, Tim, we consume 40% of the food comes from somewhere else in the world. But there are 7 billion people in the world, rather a large number of whom don't eat very well at all and are very poor. And they are going to need the resources that currently we consume. So there's a big question for the UK on, even if we could import those 40% in the future, should we be able to morally, and will we be able to economically or politically? And one of the things we have to do is actually not blame the poor for the problems that this system causes. I'm trying to paraphrase what I'm drawing from what I've heard from you. But we have a real timescale problem, because the effects of losing our biodiversity and the system collapsing actually is quite long term, or the level going up. But we actually need local action now, and we're seeing some of that. But we actually have, and I think you didn't you kind of glossed over briefly the CAP, and you've talked about subsidies for soup kitchens, but actually we have currently a massive system of subsidies and perverse incentives. So I would be quite interested to know if you've got any thoughts about how they can be redone, because the CAP is a subsidy system. Energy companies get vast subsidies from governments, we've just had more subsidies to keep extracting oil from the North Sea. So we are spending lots of money, but we're not perhaps directing it or connecting it into our need for food. And also, there's a lot of stuff that's easy and popular to do, but actually may not actually solve the problems, and not necessary. So one of the questions I'd have for you to think about, and I would like some suggestions, because we are going to produce an interim report, is what should we be asking our prospective rulers who want us to elect them in May? What should we be asking them about what their position is on how they see the future of the food system and where it fits into the bigger picture? It seems to me food is the kind of fulcrum which brings out how we want to run the society, from what you said. So it would be quite nice if you would like to say any suggestions or questions we should be suggesting people might put to their prospective parliamentary candidates throughout this election process. How do you want to see Britain run? And I think, Dale, could I paraphrase your good examples with a couple from the UK? In my lifetime, there have been two massive changes to do with driving. Seatbelts and don't drink and drive. A, culturally, but that was information, legislation and enforcement. We actually know how to change behaviour. The question is, do you want to change behaviour and for whom? But the other big thing that's come out, I think, from what you said, whatever we do to tackle these big issues, unless we do something about how poor people are enabled not to be the sufferers for it, then there will be a real problem with that, because these things will have real impacts and the people who can bear them least are likely to feel the stress most. Is that for, so that's me trying to pick out from what you said. I'd be interested in your quick responses to that. And then I say I'd like to open it up to the floor. Thank you.
A masterly summary, I think, Jeff. I haven't got any quick responses, because what you have just outlined is a fundamental reshaping of the way we run the world, in a sense. And therein lies part of the issue. If we are going to deal with making a food system sustainable, we also have to cope with changing our behaviours with respect to climate change. We also have to do the demand side management in terms of some methodology of changing us away from our overriding attitude that we can take forever an infinite amount of resource from a finite resource base. And all of these are very deep-seated viewpoints of the way we just think about our life on the planet. Fundamentally, there are resource limits to what we can achieve, the number of people who can live the way that we can live, and yet our ways of making decisions do not easily encompass that. So the long-term vision is very, I don't think we can escape from it. If we carry on the way that we are, things are going to get really uncomfortable. And who knows whether in a four or five degree world we'll be able to grow enough food for 7 billion or 8 billion or 10 billion, who knows? It might be 5 billion. So the long-term future, we know we have to change, we know we have to get towards a more sustainable food system, we know we have to decarbonise and cope with climate change, but where can we generate the political momentum to say every decision, as Gail Dale said, is every decision is a wicked problem. No one's really going to vote to have a carbon tax on beef or severe restrictions on the amount of petrol that they can buy in an attempt to decarbonise. So we live under this kind of fallacy that there are win-wins all over the place, and if we just look hard enough, we'll find a technological solution. And then we come back to the Tim Lang view. The only way that we will get this revolution is through some form of revolution. And for me, that is the real number issue. I cannot see an easy way out. We've got lots of means of nudging and small changes, but whether or not they will boil down to the direction we need, and I think food poverty or poverty associated with not being able to feed yourselves is just a proxy for all of these things that we are going to have to deal with. And I mean, look at the government's attitude to shale extraction at the moment this week. You know, that's just another decision that should be made that hasn't been made in the right way.
I'll be quite quick. I think I've thrown the question, if I was to sit down with the future leaders of this country, I think I'd throw the question to them and say, you know, how, what do they see as being the future of food, particularly in the ways that we go about eating? And my assumption would be that they will just repeat back the ways that we eat today, and just say, but more sustainable. And then I'd want to unpack those threats, because I just think, you know, we should be thinking about how we're eating as much as how we're provisioning and providing the food and the system, and that's an important, how we eat is an important part of the system, and our cultures of eating really matter. On your example, just briefly on the examples of seatbelts and don't drink and drive, you see I thought about these ones. I mean, they're interesting because they're actually reasonably good examples of evidence as to why you don't learn how to change your behaviour, or how changing behaviour takes a hell of a long time. It isn't a quick win at all. So the seatbelts started, the information campaign started around the late 50s, early 60s. It wasn't until the 1980s that governments essentially said, people aren't listening, we're going to have to legislate. But because, in a sense, they had the public opinion of how dangerous this is, it was possible to do. Drink driving has a similar sense. But mobile phones, the story essentially is, governments just thought, there's no point in having a 20-year campaign. Let's just go straight to legislation, and it became impossible to enforce because people didn't. So, you know, the sequence in which you use information, regulations, legislation, enforcement actually matters, but it does take a long time. And I think the problem within policy world, partly because of nudge, is that they think, well, behaviour change, we can do something quite neat and clever, and in 3 months' time we can have a randomised control trial, and then we can ramp that up for the whole country. There's some great examples from America of how randomised control trials have had a disastrous effect for things like education systems. You know, it works locally, but it doesn't work when you ramp it up to the state of California.
To answer your question, Deborah, what should we be asking? I think we should be asking the very former food policy that's 20, 50, 100 years in the future, but it has to be cross-party, and it doesn't matter who's in government, but somebody has to measure it. That would be an easy answer. But actually, the really big one is everybody needs to eat less. Now, I know that having just said about children going hungry, or perhaps I wouldn't extend it to children, but actually, we will eventually have to eat less, because I think we will all go hungry. You know? And so there has to be some way of eating less. So whether that's restricting access to our food supply, as in, you know, when we opened up the Sunday trading laws, etc., you know, open 24 hours. Actually, you know, that's where I would start. I would look at not providing food at petrol stations or, you know, stuff like that to stop people eating. It's never going to happen, of course, because of the corporate powers that we control our lives. But that's the sort of stuff I would go. I would just say we have to eat less.
Okay, thank you. Now, I know we're getting near to lunchtime, and we've got about 15 minutes. What I'd like to do is have an indication of people who'd like to say something. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, and I'm just going to ask you to say what you want to say and ask our evidence givers to listen to it and then to respond. Okay, I'm going to start on my left. So who started here? Yes, this lady. You would introduce yourself as well, please.
I'm Rowan West Hensel from Fair Share UK. I don't know if any of you know about Fair Share, but we redistribute surplus foods in the food industry. Last year, serving 30 million meals out of only 2% of the edible food surplus that exists. So in terms of sort of positive examples at scale, I think, you know, we offer a very kind of credible and working example. We have a dual mission to use food to tackle poverty, but also to reduce waste in the industry. So we feel really strongly that we have a really positive example of working at scale. And I think one point to make is that we're talking about people who are living in deep poverty. So the people we reach with this food access 1,700 charities across the country and voluntary organisations like homeless shelters, advice and support groups, community cafes, elderly lunch clubs, domestic violence shelters. You know, they're not people who have anything. They have no money, they have no access to a car, they can't get to a supermarket, they can't buy food at a petrol station, they have nothing. So I think, you know, in terms of solutions for reaching those kinds of people, we've got one that's working incredibly well. What we'd like to see from government is more subsidy to help us do that. So for example, AD gets subsidy, the food company sends waste food to anaerobic digestion, they get a subsidy for that. We have no issue with that, but we'd also like one for redistributing it to people. So, you know, there are lots of really positive things we feel we can be doing. There's lots of optimism about that. That's not necessarily the only solution, but when you've got enough food to feed 800 million people a year, and we're only accessing 2% of that at the moment to feed 13 million people, it's pretty shocking that we're not doing more with that food.
Thanks. I'll expect a comment from Tim on that. Next person, gentleman there, I think.
Yes, my name's Tim Warren, and I'm representing the Landscape Institute, so I'm a landscape architect. And the point I wanted to make, it's not really a question, but rather a point that I think we need to begin to conceive of food and landscape as being mutually constituted, that we cannot shape food practices, whether it's agriculture or gastronomy, without beginning to think about the spatial environments in which we find ourselves. So there's a couple of things I think that need to be addressed directly. One of them is the fact that people are disempowered in terms of food and their environment, and that is largely because of commercial pressures. The more helpless we are, the more we have to buy from service providers. So an active engagement in landscape helps people to become empowered to become part of the food supply and culinary system that sustains. So I think as a landscape architect, someone who creates scenarios for possible futures, for better futures, one thing that we have to do is reclaim the idea of utopia from the there is no alternative Thatcherism that we've been operating under since her time. And we need to be able to create scenarios and think them through that are really holistic, thinking about food and landscape coming together very much in that way. So that's just one of my time. Thank you.
Next one along from the bottom. We'll go to the top after we've done the bottom. There's two ladies there on the end of the row. You go first, you've got the mic.
Writing to the candidates and asking them what they're going to do in terms of that. But just a quick point I was going to make. I live in Sharrow, and there's a very strong group called Sharrow Green Spain, where they actually use every available bit of green land to actually do precisely that, just to grow food. And that's getting the local people involved with that. And also, I just wanted to make the obvious point about allotments. Which, you know, the chaplains and all those people growing their own food anyway, but I'm a fully green woman.
Thank you. Lady in front.
My name is Jean Gladwin. I work in public health. And I wanted to address the question of what we should be asking prospective candidates, and but also acknowledging that it's the integration of the whole system that we have to address. And so one thing I would like prospective candidates to address is not paying the minimum wage, but paying the living wage, because I think you need to bring people out of poverty so that they can afford to buy more expensive food that's been promoted. And the other thing is that I think we need to have, we need to use the examples of the stop smoking campaigns and the seatbelt campaigns, because they're examples of behavioural change that are effective, and we need to use those type of campaigns on to reducing the cost of healthy food and increasing the cost of not so healthy food.
Thanks. I think there's someone else in that block, the lady the second row back.
Laura Bernay-Custer from Sheffield Food Collective, and we raise funds for some food banks in Sheffield through different events that we put on. I just want to talk about what Dale said, really, about the fundamental changes to diet and consumption down to changes in the labour market, and suggest a solution that what this lady just said about introducing the living wage. The people can't afford the food. They can't afford food on the benefits that they're on either. And that's why people use food banks as well. It's like due to benefit sanctions or what have you. So there needs to also be changes to the benefit system and an increase in the monies received by claimants. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentleman at the top? I don't know if there's a mic or whether you can speak loudly.
My question is more to do with how our...
Who are you? Sorry, introduce yourself.
Oh, my name is David Garlowski from the Schools and Homes Energy Education Project.
Thank you.
And my question is, and we're concerned about energy use, and we talk about eating less meat, which I quite agree with, but we're not looking at milk. And milk is mainly for cows. And we're conditioned by the milk industry that we need milk as part of our daily diet. And there are people who question that need in our diet. And if you look at energy use, then you're not just talking about meat, but we also have to look at other ways the food industry tries to govern our choice of what we should have. And for my view, I mean, even though I am lactose intolerant, okay, so, but I'm fine that I'm healthier as a result. And I can see that amongst my friends and colleagues, I don't get any colds at all. At the time I'm 72 and I haven't had a cold since I was 10. You know, so what I'm saying is that we're not looking at the detail of how we make our choices for the food that we eat. And I'm just pointing out milk is one of them.
Yeah.
Because it also has implications on the illness that's created in relation to NHS and the cost of that.
Thank you.
Thank you for the time.
Commissioners, you've got a quick last chance to throw something at them, very brief. Neil, anything?
No.
Jeanette? Andrew? No? Thank you. Over to you folks. Have a go at responding to the different things you've heard, and at least two for Tim.
I'll be very quick. Living wage for sure. I mean, reducing poverty. When we live in a society where poverty is increasing, the difference between the rich and poor is increasing. Both on just a quick response to the milk and the point about anaerobic digesters. We do have government policies that are, well, not policies, there's a range of policy style information and campaigns out there which are contradictory. So I was at something in the Northwest where in the first meeting it was all about how to reduce food waste, and then £1 million for this programme. And in the second meeting it was millions of pounds for an anaerobic digester with the clause, if the other programme works, this one's knackered because we won't have enough food waste to feed through this new system. But anyway, the first one probably won't work, but let's give them both a go because we've got to spend this budget by April. And so we end up, and the same with milk. I mean, milk is interesting. It's a long history of the promotion of milk, both through governments and through businesses. And we're to then talk about having overturned what is essentially a cultural understanding and convention about a particular food. So this goes back 70, 80, 90 years. Yeah, you listen to some policymakers talking about it. We can do a campaign and we can overturn that in Sutton as well, that's where you need disruptions and the milk will poison you stories to present.
Thank you. Tim.
Okay, we could talk for hours on all of these things. I think Fair Share is utterly fantastic and a whole range of different things within this space. And I just regret the fact that in an ideal world, as Jeff said, and is summing up, it is bloody stupid to grow things, ship them around, sell them, sit in somebody's fridge or whatever, gets chucked out, recycle them. We should be in a situation where we can design a system where we're not always creating waste and then looking for a purpose to use that waste for. And that is the kind of negative. And I know just as a brief AD story, a farmer down in the southwest put in AD.
AD stands for anaerobic digestion, in case anybody's wondering what this is.
He got a grant to do it, so he then ended up giving the maize he was growing for his cattle to the digester, importing more soya-based concentrate feed. And when you do the whole life cycle assessment, the AD plant plus the soya he was going in was completely negative because it was just a counterproductive. Food and landscape, yeah, absolutely. As a landscape ecologist, I would say that would be my utopia. And there is a real issue here about consumption by peoples, by citizens, and understanding what it means in terms of nutritional value or environmental value. There's a complete deficit of information, so connecting people better. And that's why I like urban food systems, because they do start making things. Final point, milk and meat is, exactly, just didn't have time to articulate that in my mind. For me, it's not about, this commission's not really about poverty. The right question to ask is about inequality. And the greater the inequality in our society, the more painful it becomes. And the living wage and the resistance to the living wage is a question about reinforcing inequality as opposed to reducing inequality. And I think, yes, if we paid people the right
amount,
then clearly there wouldn't be the same
degree
of
poverty. Thank you. Finally.
I'll make it very quick. Absolutely, totally understood. I've got the local food plan consultation, we've got design standards and parts of the council. I'd like to say to help green the urban environment and parts of the green network, so thank you for that. Fair Share, yes, we've got a very good Fair Share in Hull as well. I totally agree that they're doing fantastic work. A lot of public health done. I think the recent figures for obesity in Germany are just starting to level off, whether it's just a blip, but maybe the message that we've been talking about for the last 10, 15, 15 time and the information that has to be out there first before people start to change is starting to have benefits. Milk, there's a lot of concern at the moment about obviously the milk farmers going out of business because and that's where the media's been about business and farmers. But of course, milk, if they do go out of dairy, they quite often go back to beef or possibly even sheep, which does equal damage to the land. I have no answers. But the inequality of the living wage, I totally support. And if you want to change the funding mechanism,
well, look, thank you all very much for the evidence giving. Thank you all for coming. And a huge thanks to Sheffield University's different staff and people involved in setting this up, who've also provided you with lunch after this. And it's arrived. I'd like to draw your attention again to the evidence sessions that we've already had. You can listen to them online, and we've had people talking about income, about culture, about the power of advertising in shaping what's going on. Where next hearing is on the food supply chain and wages and conditions, where we'll be interacting with people involved in the field in Lincolnshire. And Alan Robson is here, who's helping organise that for us. So thank you all very much indeed, and keep following what we're doing and use the interim report and see we carry this forward into make it a major issue. Thank you.